Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle 119, the first Bugle ever to be recorded during a World Cup, with me, Andy Zaltzman, here in London, and in the country that we are now basically at war with, the USA. It's the thankfully still alive, despite having spent some time in Johannesburg, John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. I am back, Andy. Back in the Northern Hemisphere, the right way up, as God and gravity intended. I'm back. It was an amazing experience, Andy, in your, everyone's roots, but I guess yours more recently than mine.
Yeah.
The best day I had there was I watched the South Africa game, the opening game, in a shebeen in Soweto, which was the best sporting experience of my life. It was so loud in there that my right ear, this is true, is still slightly ringing. It's like how you feel the morning after a Bon Jovi concert, Andy. A rattled eardrum, but completely exhilarated. I must also say hello to all the US fans that I stood with in Rustenburg at the US-England game. They were extremely friendly and incredibly restrained after Robert Green's abomination of a mistake. I still haven't quite gone over it, Andy. He didn't need to save it, Robert Green. It wasn't hit that hard. He just needed to pick the f***ing thing up. England are actually playing in 5 hours as we're doing this now. And if anything like that happens again, I'm going straight to England, Andy, to defecate on Robert Green's doorstep. I know I'll have to stand in the line, but I'll be happy to do it to make my point known.
Right. Yeah, it was a blooper, John. I mean, that was, you know...
It was a howler. It was beyond blooper. It was the next grade up, which is a howler.
That's right. It's, in terms of the great British howlers, it's up there with King Harold trying to catch that arrow in his eye at the Battle of Hastings.
Yes.
So this is Bugle 119, which means that had we been recording in the early 19th century, and that's a big had, there would now be enough bugles for record shortest serving Prime Minister George Canning to listen to one on every day of his term of office before he was unceremoniously turfed out of Downing Street due to having broken parliamentary rules on breathing. In other words, he'd stopped doing it and died. He had to go. John, the press hounded him out. Well, the Undertaker's carried him out, but it's basically the same.
Same thing.
And also means that if you turned every Bugle episode into a chicken and bribed each of those chickens to lay one egg, you could make a big enough omelette to wear it as a full-length wedding dress. Don't pretend you've never tried it, John. I've got the photos. So this is for the week beginning Monday, the 21st of June, which means it's now 50 years since the US Olympic swimming hopeful Dontell Pitchquat was disqualified after winning the Olympic 50-metre freestyle trials in a record time of 0.13 seconds. It later transpired she had fitted her starting blocks with a torpedo gun and fired herself down the pool. 75 years since, in 1935, science whiz Albert Einstein thought he'd discovered the secret of time travel before sobering up and realising he'd just been on a week-long booze binge with Hollywood star Betty Grable. And also the 200th anniversary of the day in 1810 when prize-winning novelist Jane Austen discovered the underarm squelchy. That's a fact.
Is it?
Yeah, if you read Pride and Prejudice backwards, it's all there, mate. It's all in code. It's like letters from a prison planning an escape, but more so.
Top story this week, British Petroleum update. Strike it mucky! It might seem odd, Andy, to dedicate an entire top story to a single multinational corporation, but it's perhaps less strange when the corporation in question is responsible for one of the most horrific environmental disasters of all time, Andy. Of all time. They deserve their time in the spotlight. Let them enjoy it. The Gulf oil crisis has relentlessly spewed into its 60th day now, breaking environmental records left, right and centre. And this is looking like a disaster that could be very difficult to beat. BP has become the Usain Bolt of environmental catastrophes. And they've done it through a similar, single-minded determination to be number one. The only difference between the two is the goal involved. For Bolt, it was traversing 100 metres in the quickest possible time. For BP, it was seeing how many fish it could get to float belly up off the coast of Florida. They've both succeeded beyond reasonable expectations, and one of them should be incredibly proud of himself.
Well, maybe they could, you know, having both achieved those goals, they could then try and challenge each other's records.
Yeah. You
see Tony Hayward pelting it down an athletics track.
Good idea.
And Usain Bolt just pouring bottles of oil into the sea. Of course, BP do have a safety and environmental blooper reel, almost as long as the chain of cricket bat moulds full of oil, though it
yes.
could be made from the leak, as we discovered a couple of weeks ago. You name it, when it comes to safety and environment, they've not done it, from not dumping hazardous waste in Alaska, to not running their refineries well enough to stop them exploding, to not illegally manipulating the price of propane, to not being responsible for 97% of all oil refinery safety violations in America, and being described as having a serious systematic safety problem. These are all things BP haven't done. But
yeah.
then, I guess set against that, they do have a nice corporate logo that makes you look like they give a shit about the environment, so I guess it all balances out when you think
it
of it.
It really does. Times. It's so friendly, it yeah. just makes it all confusing.
Yeah.
BP had previously made extremely confident claims, Andy, about what their safety team could handle, you know, regarding a disaster such as this. Initially, they said the rig would never sink. They turned out to be wrong about that. Then they said they could easily handle an Exxon Valdez-sized spill every single day. And turned out they were the opposite of right about that, too. To be honest, though, the warning signs were there, because looking back, they had started sounding like a professional wrestler shooting a fight promo. You cannot defeat us. We got 92,000 employees. We're ready for you. You don't scare us. Our rigs are unsinkable. Oil. I know you're watching, oil. You can't hide offshore. We're coming for you, black stuff. We'll drill you out of the ground and pump you from the bottom of the ocean. What are you going to do? Leak out of a blown well on an unfathomable scale? I'd like to see you try. If you smell what BP is cooking.
Wow.
I think I made my point.
I think you made your point, John.
BP, oil companies have never been the kind of corporations that you'd want dating your teenage daughter, Andy. You know, you can't trust them. And aside from, as you say, they're almost...
Know,
what's
know.
That?
I don't know, you know, if...
Really?
You know, if Exxon would have, you know, when Matilda's a bit bigger, you know...
Yeah. Stop
you know, as long as they treated her right, John.
Had her in by 9:30.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
You don't want this, Andy. You don't want to pursue this, Riff.
Okay, right.
As you point out, apart from their almost sarcastic logos with variations on flowers, soft shapes and the colour green, they don't even pretend to be honourable anymore. Even the names of their rigs throw up red flags now. Chevron, this is true, have a rig in the Gulf called Chevron Blind Faith. It's true. Someone actually suggested that name and a group of other people must have thought it was a good idea. Perhaps they were just trying to keep pace with the competing nearby platform Exxon Imminent Disaster. And what's become clear is that BP's response safety plans were almost comically terrible. BP's actual Gulf of Mexico oil response safety manual mentions plans for protecting walruses, which sounds great, but for the fact that walruses haven't been in the Gulf of Mexico for around 3 million years. But, you know, you can see what BP are trying to do there. It's good for confidence to get your first animal save under your belt.
Yeah.
You get into a rhythm that way. How many walruses have died due to this spill? None. Excellent. Well done, everyone. Let's call that an early lunch. The manual also lists the emergency contact phone number of a marine biology expert who has been dead since 2005. Perhaps this is a visionary move from BP. Andy, perhaps they're hoping the ghost of this man will swim down to plug the leak. Or perhaps they're just trying to improve understandably low office morale at the moment by conducting an elaborate practical joke on this man's widow, who now has to handle hundreds of daily panicked phone calls asking for her dead husband.
Well, you know, these things happen, John. These things happen. You know, if any of us have never... released a statement saying that we will look after walruses in the Gulf of Mexico, then, you know, we've got a leg to stand on.
Yeah, good point, Jesus.
But BP have been accused of cutting corners. And I would say, well, you mentioned Jesus. I would say, what's wrong with that? Because that is basically what Jesus' entire career of miracles was based on. You know, I can't be asked to go to the offy. What, say I just do one of my magic tricks with these pots of water? Abracadabra, Bulgarian Shiraz.
There's even been a live webcam set up called a spill cam,
right.
And you can see the oil pumping out of the ground, and it is both transfixing and unbelievably depressing. If anyone out there is looking for a screensaver that can make you question the point of getting up in the morning, this one is definitely for you. There have been some concerns in Britain over anti-British sentiment in America at the moment. Lord Tebbit, the ex-Conservative Party chairman and current douche, accused Obama of, and I quote, a xenophobic display of partisan political presidential petulance.
Nice before, work, Tevitt.
Before, presumably, toweling off the person he was talking to who'd spent the previous sentence being spat at.
Well, I guess, you know, when you get to Tevitt's age, you do have trouble controlling your peas.
Also, London Mayor and professional buffoon Boris Johnson complained that the United States was unleashing a wave of anti-British rhetoric. But even if that is true, Andy, our company did do this. Let's remember that. How do you think the American rhetoric would be if McDonald's had spilled 3.5 billion hamburgers off the Dover coast? It might lean a little toward the negative.
We said, but, you know, John, of the BP shareholders, it's almost exactly the same amount of British and American. You know, 40% British. I think 39% American. So I think we should have an equal amount of anti-American rhetoric.
Okay.
I want to see if Obama is the democracy fan he says he is, he should be sticking it to his own team as well. But, I mean,
That would only have been fractionally less popular than the speech he gave.
How strong is this anti-British sentiment? Because from I think the media have sort of talked it up here in Britain, because it does seem, from what I've read in some of the papers, that we might as well just have booked a cheap air ticket to Hawaii, dressed up like a Japanese aeroplane and dived into the harbour shouting kaboom.
It's not that strong. BP CEO Tony Hayward got to do what all masochists dream of when they're little kids, appear before Congress as the personification of a company. And he unsurprisingly went with the rope-a-dope strategy, keeping his defence of either forgetfulness or non-involvement high and close to his face. There were numerous areas where he denied any expertise whatsoever, saying at different points, I am not a cement engineer, and I am not a drilling engineer, and then later, I am not an oceanographic scientist.
You've been learning English out of a phrase book.
It was like it was all a game of accusatory guess who. Okay, Tony, are you a rig technician? No, I am not a rig technician. Okay, let's get rid of that. Oh, I've got it. Tony, are you an arsehole? Oh, you got it. I am indeed an arsehole.
But his efforts were considered somewhat evasive, which is perhaps not a great surprise, given his tendency to give indirect answers, which goes back a long way. And here at the Bugle, John, we've gained exclusive access to the National Educational Archives here in Britain and found Tony Hayward's O-level history exam. And it goes like this. Question one. Describe how the Normans' superior military tactics won the Battle of Hastings in 1066. Answer, that is not for me to speculate. That is a matter for the Normans and any surviving relatives of the late King Harry. I was not involved on either side in the battle and therefore was not involved in the decision-making process. Question two. Explain how the after-effects of the financial crisis caused by tulip mania in 17th century Holland affected the economic development of Europe over the next 100 years. Answer. It would be irresponsible of me to answer this question without first speaking to some Dutch people who were alive in the 1630s. And if they liked flowers so much, who am I to criticise them? Question three. Analyse why the Liberal Party declined as a political force in early 20th century Britain. No. None of your business. Get out of my face. Off. Question four. Outline the arguments for and against the use of the atomic bomb to end the war in Japan. My boy lollipop, do-do-do-do, you make my heart go giddy-up. So that's it. So he's got previous, John. I guess that's what I'm saying. And there was this interesting thing that Congressman Joe Barton, is he a congressman or senator?
I believe he's a congressman.
All right. They're basically the same as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, they're not, but push on.
All right. Basically the same, aren't they? They're just people sitting in a building saying stuff. Anyway, he said he got in trouble for basically apologising to BP. I'm ashamed of what happened in the White House yesterday. He said, I think it's a tragedy in the first proportion that a private corporation can be subjected to what I would characterise as a shakedown. In this case, a $20 billion shakedown. And interestingly, you know, for these comments, he got quite roundly slammed for it. Turned out also he'd received almost $150,000 in donations from an oil company that is a partner of BP in the Gulf. It's understandable, I guess. And a quick update on the latest efforts to stop the leak. BP and scientists have been attempting to breed a new oil-eating fish by getting a halibut to mate with a hummer. The hummer butt has currently not been a success. Rather than oil-guzzling fish, it has turned out to be a plankton-eating, needlessly big vehicle. I don't know if halibuts eat plankton. Do you know, John?
Don't know, Andy, but that to me seems like something Chris could handle.
Yeah, Chris.
Give me 30 seconds.
Right. Nice. There you go. So the walking Wikipedia is back.
No, the walking man with access to Wikipedia. Can't see Chris as we record now. We've moved studio. We've been shifted. I'm basically in a small box. So right. Some comments on the acoustic of the last couple of bugles. And it's because I'm in a box.
Mm. I'm behind you.
Yeah. That was chilling.
Yeah. But it's true and chilling.
Yeah.
Do you want the rather shoddily written Wikipedia entry?
Wow, that was quick. Yeah, go.
I've only used Wikipedia. This is my only source this time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Halibut feed on almost any animal they can fit into their mouths.
Okay, right. So that would include plankton then?
Yeah.
Animals found in their stomachs include sand lance, octopus, crab, salmon, hermit crabs, lamprey, sculpin, cod, pollock, herring, flounder, as well as other halibut.
Really? Ooh, cannibals.
Ooh, God.
That puts a whole different complexion on that joke.
Oh, that's a real undercurrent of darkness to that joke now, Andy. You sound
about,
like Doug Stanhope all of a sudden.
Yeah. I'm smoking a cigarette as we speak.
I thought I could hear your leather jacket with the sleeves rolled up. What don't you want to talk about? Halibut? Okay. Afghanistan news now, and Andy, there may, let me emphasise, may be the first piece of good news ever to come out of Afghanistan. Well, at least in the last 900 years.
Oh, come on, John. What about their cricket team qualifying for the World 2020?
Well, yeah, that was...
You can't have better news than that.
I just don't think it offsets the terrors they've been under over the last 1,000 years, Andy.
I disagree, fundamentally.
And while collectively, I'm sure both we and they will find a way to f*** this up, let's just try and enjoy this moment of unexpected positivity for what it is right now. Turns out America may have discovered a massive amount of untapped mineral deposits, possibly up to $1 trillion worth. The previously unknown deposits, including iron, copper, cobalt, gold, and critical industrial metals like lithium, are so big and include so many minerals that are essential to modern industry that Afghanistan could eventually become one of the most important mining centres on the planet. I think it's just happened, Andy. Afghanistan and good news were in the same sentence without the words "for the 10,000th day running" had no between them. This is clearly going to be a very delicate situation to handle. This news may actually, for a start, steal the resolve of the Taliban not to cede control of the country. They were fighting fiercely when all they were trying to hang on to was dust and hills. Imagine how hard they'll fight now that there's $1 trillion at stake. And also, America may now retroactively be criticised for its reasons for going to war at all. Sure, they claimed it was in reaction to 9/11 and to fucking bin Laden, but was that a smokescreen, Andy? A smokescreen for America's latest war for cobalt. It's all about gaining access to the world's supply of cobalt.
Well, you see, I mean, these things are very important metals. Iron.
Yeah.
Obviously very useful for building giant iron robots. Gold, yes. Very useful for coating these giant iron robots with gold.
Yeah.
And lithium, very useful for making the batteries that enable giant gold-plated iron robots to stomp around, breathe fire and trash talk. So, you know, we can't underestimate the influence this could have on the future of the world, really.
It does seem that Afghanistan can now add a number of items to their main traditional exports of heroin and sadness. General David Petraeus appeared on Capitol Hill this week, and he actually fainted towards the end of the first day of testimony, which prompted a complete shit fit by the media. In fact, they completely dominated their coverage of the day's hearing, and they then ignored all the details involving the thousands of soldiers who are bravely serving over there in favour of a man passing out, sitting down. Not really that dramatic. Also, this is Petraeus. He's one of the toughest, most incredible, resilient men in America. I think he can handle momentarily losing consciousness. In fact, the only reason that he fainted is clearly that he never f***ing sleeps. But judging from how easily the media were distracted from doing their job by this, there is a lesson for anyone who wants to slide something past them. Just pass out. That's obviously now what Obama should have done during his Oval Office oil spill address. We pray for the people of the Gulf, and we pray that a hand may guide us through the storm toward a brighter... Oh, God! The president fainted! Is everything okay? What a brave speech he gave, considering he fainted at the end of it. Best president ever. Lincoln never fainted, you know.
Oh, he did at the end. Pretty big style fainting. Assisted fainting. I guess that's what the doctors would call it.
Feature section now. World Cup! World Cup, Andy.
World Cup, John.
I mean, our enthusiasm is slightly tempered by the fact it's been quite a bad World Cup so far.
It's been the shittest World Cup ever, John. Let's
be honest. Well, come on, first round. First round, Andy.
Yeah, but
keep the faith.
So far, it's been the shittest World Cup ever.
It's not been great. It's not been great.
It's been bad, John. It's been really bad.
It's
really, really bad. Depressingly bad.
Well, hang in there. Hang in there. First round, Andy. First round. And, you know, also, there have been some interesting... The North Korean team, I think. It's been very interesting to see them. Of course, Kim Jong-il is a fascinating figure.
Yeah, great and goal he scored.
It was a great... Well,
fantastic goal.
It was fantastically reported, the Brazil Korea game by the North Korean news agency. Their match report didn't actually include the score. And this is their exact match report. It said, from the outset of the match, the two teams fought a seesaw battle. Not entirely true. The DPRK footballers created good shooting chances, not losing their confidence even after losing two goals. That's kind of buried in the middle of a sentence. Then it peaks, saying, at about the 88th minute of the match, Jong Tae-si headed the ball before passing it to Ji Yun-nam, who powerfully kicked it into the rival's goal mouth, scoring a goal. The DPRK team will meet its Portuguese rival on June the 21st. That's it. No mention of the word loss.
No.
No mention of the actual score. But then what do you expect? Because this is one of the greatest news agencies on the planet, Andy. In 2003, again, this is true, they reported that Kim Jong-il had played his first round of golf, finishing the 18 holes at 38 under par, including 11 holes in one that he made, one of which was on a par 5.
Well,
it then calmly ended by referring to him as easily the greatest golfer the world has ever seen. Come on. How do you not love that agency?
I'd just love to have seen his press conference afterwards. Just say, well, just everything ran for me today. But obviously, the thing with golf is, you know, whenever you think you've mastered it, comes back to bite you. So I've just got to get back on the range, come out tomorrow and try and shoot 38 under par again.
There was another great Kim Jong-il story came out during the coach's press, not it was his press conference, it was beforehand. And he said that the dear leader had given him in-depth guidance on how to develop the game in the country, and that the coach also claimed that he received regular tactical advice during matches using mobile phones that are not visible to the naked eye, a technology that Kim Jong-il personally developed. So he developed invisible phones as well as shooting 38 under par. Also, I don't know what advice that would be, other than if you don't win this game, you do know I'm going to kill you.
Right. Maybe he's suggesting
the entire team
going with a controversial formation of 5,000 men marching together whilst looking up at a great big picture of himself. Just put a football at the front of that. You can't go far wrong.
Mm.
Even the Brazilians with their flashy skills. Of course, there have been various reasons why the World Cup has not really lived up to expectations as a footballing tournament. Or what was it like actually being there at the start?
Well, the atmosphere was amazing, and you know, the atmosphere was great in the stadiums. The transport around it is chaotic at best, and there's an undercurrent of violence, but the actual games themselves were amazing. Were it not for the fact that the whole contest is being ruined by a stupid f***ing ball.
Yeah, well, this is the problem. This new ball called the Jabulani, which is basically brand new for this tournament and had hardly ever been used by anyone around the world before it. It bounces too much, it goes too fast, it doesn't go where players want to when they kick it. It's unpredictable in flight and therefore hard to control, hard to shoot and hard to pass. All of which are problems in a sport which depend on players being able to control, shoot and pass the ball. The complaints have been flooding in. Brazilian striker Robinho said, for sure, the guy who designed this ball never played football. Denmark's defender Daniel Agger said, it makes us look like drunken sailors.
Good for you, Agger.
Though, I mean, yes. I think, I mean, he does basically look like a drunken sailor anyway. Hey,
but, no, that's not true, Andy. What? He's solid at the back and he's got a thunderbolt of a shot.
Just because he's a Liverpool player doesn't mean you can deny that he looks like a drunken sailor.
No, I'm denying it. Just because he's got tattoos, Andy.
Another Brazilian striker, Luis Fabiano, said, "All of a sudden it changes trajectory on you. It's like it doesn't want to be kicked. I think it's supernatural."
Right, that's the best quote so far.
There is maybe, some. It is a god. The football is god.
Yeah.
American goalkeeper Marcus Hanneman, although I like to think of him as former temporary Gillingham goalkeeper, Marcus Hanneman. He said, "Technology is not everything." Talking about why this new ball had been developed. "Technology is not everything. Scientists came up with the atom bomb. That doesn't mean we should have invented it." Although,
that's it. Get it in perspective.
To be fair to the scientists who came up with the atom bomb, they came up with it, but then they didn't give the crew of the Enola Gay a special new one for the big day that swerved unpredictably in flight. And why, you may very well ask, are the world's top footballers being asked to adapt to a completely new type of ball?
Ooh, good question.
At the most tournament in most important tournament in the sport. Now, the obvious answer, of course, John, you might think, is because the people running the sport are obviously quits and charlatans, willing to sacrifice the integrity and success of their showpiece event for the sake of a marketing gimmick, a bunch of unadulterated donkey shits. But you would, of course, be wrong, John, because the correct answer is it's coming. The reason this new ball for a new tournament. The reason is that no previous football, John, had ever worked.
Right.
None of them had worked, John. You know, up until, it's basically, this has been brought in so the game is no longer spoilt by the curse of inadequate footballs that had totally failed to function, that has held the game back for so long. I mean, imagine how much worse this World Cup would have been if they'd had to play with a cubic ball made of lead.
Oh, God, it would have been awful, Andy.
So I think we should stop complaining about...
Yeah, you're right. Now you put it in perspective, it's been a really incredible World Cup so far.
How were the Vuvuzelas when you were there? I mean,
it's loud, definitely, but it's quite fun. Yeah. You know, it contributes to the atmosphere there. I do think the reaction to it has been ridiculous.
Right, because watching on television, I mean, probably get a different perspective.
Yeah.
It's just blotted out all other sounds usually associated with football matches, such as the crowd and the sense that exciting stuff is happening.
Right.
It seems, the defence of it, that it's part of South African culture. And, you know, why not celebrate such a glorious historic cultural achievement as a mass-produced plastic one-note horn dating back to the 1990s that makes all things sound identical to each other, with a range of artistic impression ranging from honk all the way to honk, it's a goal, honk, it's not a goal, honk, it's nearly a goal, honk, that looked like a penalty, honk, he kicked another player in the plums, honk, Satan himself has appeared on the bench and is starting stretching his hamstrings, I think the Prince of Darkness might be about to come on, honk, the devil just nutmegging Lionel Messi before firing an unstoppable pile driver in from 45 yards and celebrating by eating and regurgitating all his teammates before picking up a second yellow card for taking his shirt off. Is that what football supporters come to?
You just can't read the difference in the inflections, Andy.
It's a soul-sapping, this is really how it was described, a soul-sapping drone, like listening to 20,000 John Kerry impersonators talking simultaneously whilst holding a collection of electric toothbrushes and standing guard over miniature replica stadiums full of mosquitoes amplified to 1,000 times their normal volume. Or like being in an incredibly overcrowded cafeteria surrounded by 100,000 indecisive diners mulling over what dessert to have. It's as if no crowd has turned up, and the stadium organisers have compensated by playing a CD containing highlights of the world's greatest rush hour traffic jams. Also, another problem with the World Cup has been unfeasibly negative tactics by coaches such as former England coach Sven-Goran Eriksson, coaching a very talented Ivory Coast team, who left his best player on the substitute bench for fear that he might score a goal and spoil everything. And it seems that many football coaches and managers clearly feel they've been put on earth with a divine mission to drain the joy from the lives of millions. Your emails now, and, well, we've had a number of emails along these lines. This one comes from Jane, who writes on that subject, simply USA versus England. "Dear John and Andy, f*** You and your Butterfingers goalie. USA. USA. Yep. USA.
Fair enough.
Lots of love, Jane.
Fair enough, Jane. The point stands.
P.S. Chris, you're doing an awesome job. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. Yeah.
I feel after the first half of her email, I find it hard to accept the second part.
Oh, fair enough.
Excellent... A number of you have sent in an outstanding piece of someone drawing a massive wang on a bridge that some of you put on the Twitter feed and also emailed in St. Petersburg. Apparently it was to celebrate the birthday of Che Guevara on the Tieni Bridge in St. Petersburg. They drew a 213-foot-long penis.
Oh dear, never not funny.
Thanks for do keep us alerted, buglers.
Yeah, do. I mean, it's just such a great sequence of emails to get. It's good, you know, it's good to know what's going on in the world. It gives you a lust for life. There's a great email here with a great opportunity offer from Dave Thackeray, who says, John and Andy, in order of douchiness when it comes to the US national soccer team. Fair enough. That's me there. He says, I would like to offer the Bugle an amazing sponsorship deal. I'm getting married in October. How would you like to make the Bugle the official podcast of the wedding?
Wow.
For just a few dollars investment, you can reap the benefits when it comes to my upcoming nuptials. What do you think, Ant?
Okay, I mean, what's a few dollars? What's he talking about?
Well, there are sponsorship levels.
Yeah.
He says, first, $50. The Bugle becomes the official podcast of the Thacker and Tom Chack wedding.
Right.
Selected guests will each receive a CD of Bugle 69, titled possibly the longest penis joke in the world ever. Yeah. Okay, that's $50. For $100, the groom gently encourages four people to listen to the Bugle after six or seven Jack and Cokes at the wedding reception. After the fourth such attempt to recruit a new bugler, he gets interrupted by an immediate urge to vomit, though not because of the Bugle recommendations. That's very specific. For $250, the entire bridal party listens to the newest episode of the Bugle at high volume while getting dressed for the ceremony. I'm not sure you're going to get the wedding after that. It fulfills one part of the decades-old bridal superstition, something old, something new, something borrowed, something containing bullshit. Excellent. For $1,000, that's good. That's tempting at $250. For $1,000, either Mr. Oliver or Mr. Zaltzman gets invited to the reception, but has to act as seat filler for any guest who leaves momentarily to visit what the British call the loo.
Does that include the bride or groom?
I don't know.
Because I'm already taken. You'll have to do that, John.
Okay. $2,000. A giant banner is hung at the reception site featuring the non-photoshopped faces of Mr. Zaltzman and Mr. Oliver with a slogan of their choosing.
Right. Oh!
Plus a black bar across the right side of the banner in honour of the passing of Tom, former producer extraordinaire. He's not physically dead, but he's dead to us now. Tempting. That whole slogan of their choosing is a very dangerous...
What would you go with? Statistically, there's a big chance this is going to end in tears.
That's $2,000. $4,000, groom, best man, groomsman, and at least three invited guests learn how to play cricket and are forbidden to make fun of cricket and other ridiculous sports for the time period of 5 years. Ooh, okay. Right. $5,000, the Bugle becomes the official podcast of the honeymoon, covering most of the cost of travel expenses for a European excursion. Not a lot in that for us.
And what do we get for that?
Yeah.
What exactly do we get for that?
I've just read $10,000, though, Andy.
Right.
It's a lot of money. Okay. That's a lot of money.
But you're doing all right these days, aren't
you? I'm not denying that. Yeah, I'm doing okay. Still a lot of money. Groom allows John and Andy to write his vows.
Oh, yes.
Video proof will be provided and will become the sole property of the Bugle for remixing purposes with Mr. Oliver's dope beats and rhymes. Let's make this happen. Dave Thacker, a groom.
Right, that is tempting. I mean, that really is tempting.
It's a great email.
What's the chance of the guru going to sequel, John? That could fund it.
Let's spend a week thinking about that. We'll get back to you next week, Dave. Great email.
I tell you, well, let's open this up to other buglers. If you have any suggested vows for this wedding or any other wedding, then do email them in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. And this email came in, and this was also something brought to our attention on the Twitter feed at Hello Buglers. Do join in the bullshit. This comes from Lord Halliburton Spencerfield of Huddersfield, apparently.
Uh-huh.
Although I don't believe that is an actual name. judging by the actual name at the top of the email. But anyway, subject, the best first sentence of a news story. Dear Andy and John, in order of hairiness. I was perusing the internet, and I came across the best opening sentence of a news story since Berlusconi was hit in the head with a miniature version of Milan Cathedral.
God, it was so good, that story.
It was good. I think this might be better. And here it is. A German student created a major traffic jam in Bavaria when he mooned a group of Hell's Angels, hurled a puppy at them, and then escaped on a bulldozer.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. What a story. Does that check out?
Apparently so. Yeah. Apparently drove into the grounds of the Hell's Angels clubhouse, dropped his pants, threw the puppy, and then fled, stole a bulldozer from a nearby construction site and attempted to drive it to Munich.
Apparently, what motivated him to throw a puppy at the Hell's Angels is currently unclear, said a spokesman for the local police.
But the puppy is safe, apparently. The puppy is...
That's good. That's good.
He's safe on a massive motorcycle. Bugle Sport now, and no sports section. We've already done the World Cup feature section, and we've run out of time.
Yeah.
So
I did want to offer my condolences to Paul, Andy, who is very upset about the Celtics losing to the Lakers. He's a big Boston fan.
Yeah.
And Paul, he's not doing too well.
Yeah.
Next year, Paul, next year, if your old men retire and you get new players in their place, kick it. I'm sorry.
Apparently there were riots after it in LA.
Yeah, that's right. They smash stuff when they win.
That's bizarre.
Yeah.
But what's the thinking behind that?
I don't know. I guess not much is the answer.
So that's great. It for this week's Bugle. A quick word on the website. The Times paywall has now gone up, as you probably know. So the old Bugle webpage is no longer available now. Stop crying, all of you, come on. No quivery bottom lip, come on. You're all big boys and girls. Put yourselves together.
What does that mean?
And realise that even without a Bugle webpage, life is still worth living.
I don't know if that's true. What does that mean?
Well, it means that apparently we will get a new Bugle page in time on the new Times website. But far as we've been told, the podcast is remaining free by iTunes and the much complained about RSS feed.
All right, okay.
But that's just a little update, Buglers. So I'm afraid that all the stuff you put on that previous webpage, I don't know if it's gone forever. Is it gone forever, Chris, or can we get it back?
I don't know.
He doesn't know. He doesn't work here. He's freelance, doesn't he?
He's watching the US Slovenia game.
That's right. So a quick forecast, John.
Yep.
With Germany having lost today,
yes.
England not looking too convincing, and Slovenia beating America as we speak, it's looking very possible it could be an England-Germany second-round match.
Oh, please no.
Which we would inevitably lose.
Yes, please
probably no. To a massive deflected goal or on penalties.
Yeah.
Is that how... that looks almost certain now.
Yeah.
It's not really a... This is not really a forecast. This is just new. This is just preemptive news.
Yeah, it's just a Greek tragedy.
England are
going
to lose to Germany on penalties in the second round.
Oh no!
I mean, I just think after what they did in the war, should they even be allowed in the World Cup?
I agree, Andy. Got to put a century between that. Century between that and
at least,
and
at the very least, they're still.
I've hiccuped. Excuse me.
At the sheer preemptive disgust at the thought of England going out to Germany again.
Hiccuped for ages.
Yeah, it's good to get back on the horse, isn't it?
Yeah, felt pretty good.
Enjoy it.
Yeah. There you go. First hiccup on the Bugle, Andy. That's 1-0 to me.
I'm going to come back strong next week, though.
Okay. Have a great week, Buglers.
Bye-bye.
Bye.